let's discuss it afterwards. Yeah. Okay. Now, let me tell you how you can reproduce this by some matrix model. So let me consider an n-by-n Hermitian matrix. And let me consider the following integral here, where the measure is just the real values of the matrix element and the imaginary values of the Hermitian matrix element. So just kind of flat measure. This is just a trace of the matrix. And I take here case power of trace phi cube. I put in some arbitrary factors here for convenience. So let us consider this, and let us try to calculate this integral here. Well, so it's a Gaussian integral. So if you have two values here, like this, and you perform this integral, then you just get a delta function here in the indices, like this and like this. They appear asymmetric because of the way that this appears here. So the 1 over n simply comes from the n here, which we put in by hand. Now, so what is the geometric interpretation of this trace phi cube? So I've written it down here in matrices. Now let me associate a triangle with it in the following way. To the corners, I associate alpha, beta, gamma, and then I associate the matrices covered the links. Now, Wieck's theorem, well, tells me when I have, so if I have such a term here, so let's go back to the original thing here. When we want to calculate this matrix integral here, well, or just view it as an ordinary integral, then we, since this is a Gaussian integral, we just apply Wieck's theorem here, so we have all possible contractions which appear here. Now let me take a phi from one of these terms and a phi from another trace phi cube term. I take one of the matrices out and one from the other phi cube term. That means I have two triangles and I have an assignment kind of like this. And now I apply Wieck's theorem, and this means that I have to identify corresponding indices. So in a way, I can view this mentally as a gluing of these triangles, where now these links here become internal links, so kind of disappear, but we can keep them in the drawing. So we glue this together. And in the end of the day, when we have done all our Wieck contractions here, all links, all the three links, all the three K links, which are in these K triangles, have been glued together. And well, if you work out the details, it turns out that the symmetry of this, in order to create closed surfaces, in general, these surfaces will be disconnected, is exactly such that we should put in 1/3 here and 1/k factorial here. In this way, we will generate all kinds of, in general, kind of disconnected surfaces by this gluing. We will generate them automatically. The weight of a given triangulation constructed this way depends on n, though. So let us consider a connected triangulation. So what happens? Well, when a vertex in this gluing process, so here I've glued already a number of triangles here, when a vertex becomes an internal vertex, when we close this link here, finally by gluing, we create a factor n, because we are gluing this phi to this phi, but they share the same beta, we are summing over beta, so we get a factor n here. So when each vertex in the gluing becomes an internal vertex, so eventually all vertices will become internal, we will create a factor n. So for each triangle, we had put in by hand a factor n and a factor g. So for each triangle, we have a weight like this. For each link, each propagator, each gluing, each time we got an internal link, we were gluing two together, we were doing the Gaussian integral, we got a factor 1/n. So this is 1/(total n) to the number of links. And finally, for each vertex, we got this thing here. So the total weight of this, apart from the combinatorial weight coming into this, will be g to the nt, and then this arbitrary variable n into this power here. But this is just the Euler characteristic of the triangulation, the number of triangles minus the number of links plus the number of vertices. So this is the topological quantity associated with the given triangulation. So somehow remarkable, everything, you get the combinatorics right by doing this. I will not give you the detailed arguments of this, I will just tell you that this is a fact. Then you see that this partition form, so I had this summation with 1 over k factorial of all powers here. So clearly I can put it formally up in the exponent here, and I can claim that this is a generating function for all disconnected surfaces. I prepared it like this. This colon goes here. So here we generate all disconnected surfaces, but we know of course that to get the connected diagrams, we need to take the log of this partition function. So this here is all the connected surfaces. And this has then an expansion like this in terms of Euler characteristic and in terms of the coupling constant and in terms of the combinatorial weight which is associated with a given triangulation. And this combinatorial weight comes out exactly right. Now, our starting point of the whole thing was that we wrote down this partition function exactly in this term here. This was the Einstein action. This was the cosmological action, and this is again the combinatorial weight. So you see that you have the simple identification between the matrix model and what we have already done, that the gravitational coupling constant is log of n, and g is equal to e to the mu. We have already used that kind of identification once. But here the g is the g in the coupling in the matrix model. So we have this kind of definition. And it's now you can immediately kind of generalize it. Instead of taking a third order polynomial, you can take any polynomial here. You still keep the Gaussian term. You take any polynomial here, and then this thing here is going to be the kind of generating function for our counting. Of course, it's a formal expression because you want this minus sign here, and you want these guys to be positive. Because when you Taylor expand this, I mean, you want these to appear with positive powers because you want each polygon to appear with a positive power. I mean, we don't know what it means to appear with a negative weight when we sum our surfaces. So we want something like this. So it's a purely formal definition. This matrix, as it stands here, this matrix integral doesn't exist. But it exists, of course, as a formal power expansion where you just keep the Gaussian term up here and you power expand this. And then, when you do the weak contractions, you get automatically the correct result. So that's, of course, very neat. But of course, I mean, to make it complete, I would have to argue for you that you really get the correct weights, and I haven't done that, but we'll just take it as a statement. Now, if we take the trace of phi to the n, in this means that we sum our all connected triangulation whose boundary is an n-gon here. Because what are we calculating here? So we power expand, let's take the cubic action. We power expand, so we have this trace already kind of standing here, and then we power expand in our term here. And now we contract, we do our Gaussian integration, we contract in all possible ways. That means that we glue the triangles to the boundary, and then eventually this will form a kind of closed surface because all these will be glued together. There will be no free indices coming from here. So we get exactly triangulations with one boundary of length n in this way. And now we can, of course, sum over all possible lengths of boundaries, kind of like this. I get some expectation value should appear here. Add some n. And you see that we can formally write this as a trace of this resolvent. So the trace of this resolvent here is exactly what we call the Hartle-Hockel wave function with cosmological constant and boundary cosmological constant. Where I've just introduced by hand this boundary cosmological constant. It's just an auxiliary variable. And similar, the multi-loop things we get as the connected part of the trace, the product of these kind of traces there. So you can calculate all this using matrix models. One other nice thing, you can So these are kind of Hermitian matrices, so they have real eigenvalues, and you can define formally the eigenvalue density as the expectation value of such a formal expression here. And then, of course, with this definition, then you see that trace of this is by definition equal to an expression like this. And now you put it in here, up here, and you see that our W is written in this way here. So we can, well, since we now have been so clever that we have already calculated this thing, we can indeed calculate the chi density from the matrix model because of the knowledge of this thing here, if you want. Not that we need it in a disparate way, but we can do it here. I think I will not do it. No, I've not done it. Yeah, I have done this. Sorry, I take it back. So if we assume the cut as before, then you see that this is we saw that this was analytic in the complex place outside the cut, and this means that from this integral equation, that the density is simply given by approaching the cut from both sides with W in this way, and then you can construct the density. And since we know the W here, you see that approaching from both sides, this V plays no role because this is analytic, but we get a sign change here coming from the cut when we come from both sides, and the density is simply given by this expression here. Now let us just see what it means in the simple case where we put the coupling constant equal to zero. So we only have the Gaussian potential, just for seeing what it means. So we only have the Gaussian potential. So now let's look at an object like this. So what does it mean, such an object? Well, we are instructed to perform this integral here. But now we have no phi cube terms to power expand in. We just have this. So we only have kind of self-contractions of this link. This is the trace I've drawn here. And if you take two phis, a phi here and a phi here, we are going to glue these two together. We're going to identify these. And we have to do this with all of them. And what do we end up with as a drawing? Something like this. So this is exactly branch polymers. And you see that was why I apart from things being nice also combinatorially, I wanted to keep these branch polymers because they appear kind of trivially in the matrix model. Even if you had phi cube here, there would also have been self-contractions of this part here, which would have been gluing these together. So they appear in a natural way here. But as we have seen, they don't change any universality or anything. So in this case, this function was very simple. We calculated it explicitly to be like this. And we see that the density is something like this. So this density is exactly Wigner's semicircle law for Gaussian matrices. And you now see that we have derived it from branch polymers, which is kind of cute. And when I discuss universality, so this is in a way, this place in a certain way, in a certain context, which I'll not discuss in detail, it plays the same role as the Gaussian distribution does for the central limit theorem. And you will see, we will discuss this, you will see that in our context, this statement will be the following, that branch polymers will be the generic state of these triangulations. And you have to fine-tune something, you have to work hard to get something else. So it has an equivalent statement there. So finally, what I want to mention is how to get the loop equations from the matrix models. So I'm a little bit short here because we will not really need it too much in the further, but it's nice to see how smoothly it works in a way. So I will use the Dyson-Swinger technique, namely a field rate definition. So let me make the following field rate definition. I'm free to do that. It is this thing here. Well, of course, it only makes sense if this is outside the cut of this, but let us discuss these technical details. It's easy to check that the measure making this field rate definition will change in this way here. The potential will change in this way here. And of course, the matrix integral itself is formally invariant under such a change of variables, so it doesn't change. So putting the thing to first order an epsilon, putting this contribution equal to zero, we get two terms coming, this coming from the measure, this coming from the action. This has to be equal to zero. Now, what is this? This is the expectation value of trace of this squared, but it's not the connected part. It's the whole thing. So it's the disconnected part. This is just the trace itself squared plus the connected part. So here we have this plus the connected part. And this part here, with a little bit of rewriting, it's the expectation value of this. Now let's introduce the density, since we have already worked with it. So it can be written kind of like this. And now let's use that the density was related to W in this way here. So we actually use this relation. I guess this is why I wrote it down in the first place. So here we are integrating over the cut. But now using this, we can make this deform the contour outside the cut precisely in this way, but not including this point. And you see that this is this plus this plus this equal to zero is nothing but the loop equation. It's a rundown. So this is how it appears from kind of matrix models. So that's very simple. But I will go to some physics now, namely the continuum limit. So I haven't discussed in detail the continuum limit here. So now let me finally do it. So I remind you that this is the cosmological constant, this is the boundary cosmological constant, and these were the redefined variables that we had. Now, naively, we would expect, and this turns out to be true, that as we saw already for the particle, that they should have an additive kind of renormalization. So since this cosmological constant has dimension of mass dimension 2, then we expect that we have an additive mass normalization like this for the cosmological constant, where this is the lattice spacing. And we have a similar thing for the boundary cosmological constant, where this is some continuum boundary cosmological constant. So these are supposed to be the renormalized continuum cosmological and boundary cosmological constants. So at the critical point here, that means at a certain critical point here, the number of triangles goes to infinity. And similar for any g at the critical value of this, the boundary links, number of boundary links goes to infinity. So now let us write down this in terms of these variables here. This went like a lambda a squared. I only expand now to first order here, so I get something like this. And similar, this goes like this. I expand to first order, I get something like this. So you see that in terms of these other variables, it looks like the following. Delta g, when we are close to this critical point, should go like the cosmological constant times a squared, well, times some constant which I absorb in the cosmological constant. So I will simply write delta g equal to lambda a squared to lowest order. And delta z equal to some continuum z times a. So this just reflects the dimension of these coupling constants. And now I remind you that I told you that this M1, this moment M1, close to the critical point, had this kind of behavior here. So this is all we need, in fact, to discuss the continuum limit. Yeah. A is the lattice spacing of the triangle. So I put it equal to 1 originally when I did all this, but now I reintroduce it here.
On the pixel.
Well, on any lattice. So I now say, I imagine that I have a V, continuum V, which is equal to N times A squared. So I introduce such a thing, A, associated with each of these things. So when I have in the action, I will always end up getting an expression like minus mu critical times K. So this is G critical to the power K, basically. So I have something like this. Now introduce this, you see that this goes to E to the minus lambda A squared K. And now call this the continuum volume, then you see that this is minus lambda continuum volume. So in this way you see that the action, if you include the entropy factor in the action, you get exactly the continuum value. as happened for the random walk. So now let us first, well, we'll consider all kinds of situations now, but maybe let us first consider h equal to 0. So genus equal to 0, but with a number of boundaries where the number of boundaries are larger than 3. So I have already, in principle, calculated my Hartle-Hawking one loop function, and I now apply my loop insertion operator two times to get, or b times to get the 3-point function, or the b-point function. And remarkably, well, believe it or not, there is a closed expression for this. And I've written it down here. So this is valid even away from any critical point. There is such a marvelous expression here. Where again, I remind you that this M1 is given by such an integral, but it's not important. Well, this is technical, but it's not important for us. And you see, well, we already discussed that the singular behavior occurred when M1 goes to 0. And you see that this is very clear in this formula, because when M1 goes to, only M1 appears here. And when M1 goes to 0, clearly this expression is divergent. And this was exactly what we found for, say, the propagator of the free particle and so on, that the lattice one was equal to some divergent A factor in front of it times the continuum value. And this is exactly what will appear here too. But now if we can use this to squeeze a lot of information out of our general formulas. Because I now use that close to the critical point when I approach it, M1 was equal to this thing here. And then I see that, so now let me take some sets which are not close to the cut. So this means that the boundary is not critical. So I'm insisting that the boundary length doesn't grow, but the number of triangles grow. So what does it mean? It means that relatively speaking, the loop shrinks to points. We call them punctures then. They shrink to punctures, and you have this huge surface consisting of many triangles. And then we see that the behavior of this, the singular behavior of this, is given as a delta G in this way. And I write it also in terms of kind of the renormalized cosmological constant in this way here. And if I formally take B equal to 0 here, I also get the right result, even if I only had derived this for B larger than or equal to 3. But I'll just take B equal to 0 to shorten discussion. I get the right result, and we have something like this. Okay, so now let me once more remind you about the kind of relation between, so we have delta, this is delta G here, and it appears in this power. Now let me expand this as a power series kind of around this point here, and I have this expansion here. And so this is an exact expansion, and if I now take this coefficient and expand it in K, I get precisely this thing here. So this relation is exactly the one I told you before, where we only use it for Z instead of G. If you have a gamma here, we get the same gamma minus 1 here. So we have an expression kind of like this. So you see that we have now managed actually to count these number of triangulations. So we have counted the number of triangulations in a situation where we have these boundaries, but since we haven't taken set to the critical value, these L's are small, like 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, something like this, but this K is very large, then asymptotically, it will go like this. So it grows exponentially, as have been promised to you, and there are some power laws. And for the partition function itself, we have something like this. And we can repeat this argument for any topology. Only will the power change from this power to this power here. So for each genus, there's added a 5/2 defined by H. If you solve the loop equations, you find precisely this. So we have also managed to count now with the number of triangulations for any genus with B punctures here. And it goes like this. And for the partition function itself, we have something like this. So note the following. For a given H, we have the same exponential growth. But each time the topology changes, the power changes. So in a way, there becomes more and more triangulations for higher topologies because we have a positive power here. But if you kind of reverse the logic and say, let me take a given k, a large k such that this formula is still valid, but a given k, and now let me increase h, then you see that, well, if you have k triangles, you can, of course, glue it together such that you create a surface of almost genus k. But if you put in k here, then you see that you get k to the 5 half over k. So this is, of course, much larger than this exponential growth. So in a certain way, you see that there are so many surfaces of high genus that they totally swamp the whole situation. And this is going to haunt us kind of later when we try to sum all these things. But this is what comes out of the counting situation. So everything is perfectly hunky-dory if we kind of restrict us to a fixed topology, no matter what it is. But if we want to sum all topologies, well, we'll have to think a little bit further, and this is what I'll discuss in a moment. But before discussing that, yeah. What sense?
That the genus is, yeah, but I mean, I would imagine that the k is some, that k should be much bigger than some global characteristics of a surface.
Well, I guess you have, I mean.
If n holds, then k should be much bigger than n. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, this is what I say.
Oh, okay.
So I say, in general, you would expect to be able to construct, for a given k, an h of order k. Why? You can glue, you don't need, I mean, let's say it's k divided by 2. You can clearly easily glue triangles together in some fancy pattern, such that you create a higher genus.
But I keep thinking of geometry as being approximated by your piecewise linear structure.
Well, I mean, we have no choice. Once you have defined the rules,
so
we but well, I think that's the wrong way of looking at it. Well, yeah, I think it's the wrong intuition. Yeah. So to complete my job, let me return here finally to, well, not finally, but to h equal to 0. And so before I, in order to discuss the number of triangulations, I was keeping the boundary fixed and didn't let them grow in the same way as with the triangles. But now I want, at the same time, to let this set go to this critical value. So it turns out that if you work out the details, that this is equal to the critical value plus something like this. This guy here is equal to this critical value plus this thing we have defined here. So this difference disappears everywhere. This is given by this magic z plus the square root of the boundary cosmological constant times a. And now you can simply insert. So the kind of remarkable fact here is that you can take this formula here, which is valid anywhere away from the critical point, and you can simply insert in it this renormalized value, and you get immediately out the continuum Hartle-Hawking wave functions. So what do they look like? So you see that we have the following prescription. So here is the discretized one. We get a prefactor of A, and then we get the continuum one coming out here. This is exactly like in the random walk. There's a usually divergent kind of prefactor, at least if B is sufficiently large, namely 3 and larger. There is a kind of divergent, well, even 2. There is a divergent prefactor. But not for b equal to 1. And the expression for the continuum wave function is explicitly here. And I can inversely Laplace transform this back to fixed L if I want. So here you have your Hartle-Hawking wave functions. So they look almost embarrassingly simple. I've gone through all this pain to calculate something which is as simple as that. But I tell you, you have to go even through more pain if you want to calculate these in the continuum framework. It was first done by Samolodnikov and Samolodnikov, and it was not easy for them, I tell you. So here it is. So it agrees exactly with what you get from continuum results, and it's nice. So for the ordinary Hartree-Hawking wave function itself, it turns out that this limit here, you see, if b is equal to 1, then this exponent is actually positive. So when you take the limit, you get a non-universal part, namely this potential here, and then you get the power 3/2 times what you would call the continuum Hartree-Hawking wave function, which is given in this part. I will return to this. This part actually plays a little role later in the discussion, but we will just leave it like that at the moment. And I will turn now to maybe the most interesting question, which is here. Can summation over genus H. And this is, of course, interesting, because it's also of, well, in quantum gravity, we don't really know whether you should sum over topologies or not. I mean, classically, there's, I guess, no real motivation for doing it. Whether you should do it in a quantum theory is kind of your choice. You can try to do it. You can insist that this is not what happens, but nobody knows. But in string theory, you have to sum over topologies of the two-dimensional surfaces given the string. And it has never been defined non-perturbatively. So therefore, it's of course very interesting, even in such toy models here, to see whether one can do it or not. So I remind you about the expression I started showing you. So this is the partition function we want to start out with. So this is the sum of all genus. This is the Einstein-Hilbert action, topological. And here we have the boundary cosmological constant. Chi is equal to 1 minus h. Now what we have just calculated is that this thing here is a number which I haven't bothered, well, not bothered, but which I haven't calculated for you. It's not so easy to calculate, but it can be calculated. Times this factor here, which I have kind of argued, it disappears. So this was exactly the singular scaling behavior. Now, you can wonder, how can such an expression here ever make any sense when we take a to 0? Because you see, when h becomes larger and larger, it clearly becomes more and more singular here. So there seems no natural way to absorb it, except for one. Namely, we clearly have to absorb this divergence which appear here in our gravitational our kappa, Einstein's gravitational coupling constant. So it didn't play any role for a fixed genus because it's just topological, but once we start to change genus, of course, it comes into play as a real, kind of real gravitational coupling constant, I guess. And in fact, we are forced to absorb it, and the randomization of it is given uniquely by insisting that this quantity here stays finite. So the randomization of it is given in this way here. So really, you see, there's only one coupling constant in this theory. Even if you started out with two, there's only one. This is this renormalized gravitational coupling constant. Once you insist on summing over all genus, there's really a gravitational coupling constant, and it is here, and this is the only one, which is there. This thing can be absorbed in it. So you see that the normalization of the cosmological constant is linked to the normalization of the gravitational coupling constant. So we have a kind of double scaling limit. So this is the famous double scaling limit in non-critical string theories, of which I guess close to 2,000 papers have been written without any further understanding have been achieved, I would say, but at least it had kept the physicists busy. So it's exactly that. And it appeared first in the context of matrix models, because you might recall that I told you that in the matrix models, this log n was equal to this coupling constant here. And you see then that if I write this as log n, then what it tells me is that the product of n and a to the 5/2 should be kept as a constant. So you want to take a large n limit, which is a kind of the gravitation, the bare gravitation coupling constant going to 0. And then at the same time, you want to scale the lattice spacing to 0. So now we end up with this wonderful expression here, which I have also written in the string context. So it's a summation over genus of we know this number, we have this coupling constant, and I write it instead of, if I take this 2 up here, then it becomes a string coupling constant squared, because in the string theory, when you change genus for closed strings, I mean, you have your loop and you move around, then you split up, that's one coupling constant, and then you join again, that's another. So you get the string coupling constant squared. So this is, well, I tried to write that here, although it's not so clear. So now we need to perform this sum. So what is this number here? And it turns out, after all the dust have settled, you can calculate it, that for large h, it goes like 2h factorial. So you have, unfortunately, an expression here which you don't know really what to do with, because it is not even Borel summable, and because all the terms here are positive, and they grow very fast. So you can say, aha, okay, bad. So we don't know anything of this, but maybe we can use the matrix models to define this sum, because we had some matrix models. And, well, until now I said they were useless, but now let's put them into use. So if you look at the matrix model itself, let's take the simplest one with the 5 cube. Well, it's clearly of no help because it's not even defined. I mean, what is this 5 cube? It's unbounded from below and so on. But now let me make this rotation of phi. Let me put in this phase factor here. Then I get a complex matrix integral like this. So this complex matrix integral is well defined. And in fact, if you check, it has the same perturbative expansion in the coupling constant as the original one. So all these phase factors, they cancel out in any power series in G that you do. So it is as good as the other one for our purpose. I mean, we only introduced this matrix model anyway as a little tool for doing the combinatorics. And actually, this matrix model will do exactly the same, because it gives exactly the same power expansion in G. And nevertheless, it is well defined. So do we have here a non-perturbative definition of two-dimensional quantum gravity? That would be wonderful, huh? Unfortunately, life is not so simple, because it turns out that, well, since now complex values are involved here, it turns out that, in fact, it is imaginary also. It has an imaginary part which involves this coupling constant to the inverse power. So we will never see this in some perturbative expansion, but nevertheless, it is there. And it turns out that you get similar results if you do not take only two-dimensional quantum gravity, but any two-dimensional quantum gravity coupled to unitary matter, it's the same story. We have not found any way to use these matrix models to define the non-perturbative contributions in any convincing way which you can use. However, I would like to point out to you that there are certain non-unitary series where one can use the matrix model to define the summation over all genus. So let me now mention that to you, and let me stop to that. So let's see, where the hell am I? So now let me consider the next simplest matrix model, where I have a phi cube and a phi to the fourth. So the partition function is given by this. I'm gluing together triangles and squares coming from here and here. And of course, this is equally ill-defined as we discussed as before, because in order to represent gravity, we have to take this coupling constant to be larger than zero, which is necessary if we want these squares to appear with positive weight in the surface. But now let us, for a second, let us close our eyes and say, I don't care about this stupid thing. Let me allow this G4 to be negative also. Then, of course, this matrix integral here is kind of well defined, because now we have when phi goes to infinity, this has the right sign, and this is a perfectly well defined integral. Now, if you want to view it as a surface, it's a kind of, well, we don't really know what to think about it right now, because now we are doing the triangles with positive weight and the squares with negative weight. So, is it still quantum gravity, or is it something weird? It turns out that it has an interpretation as quantum gravity. So, but maybe not the one that one would think of. So let me mention that to you because it is quite interesting. So now let me draw the coupling constant space here of G4 and G3. So if G4 was equal to zero, then we were here. It was our gravity thing, and anywhere out here, we still have ordinary 2D gravity. In fact, 2D gravity was characterized by the fact that this coefficient, the first coefficient, was equal to zero, and the two other ones were less than zero. And I've drawn the line here because this is the case. And everywhere there, we just get ordinary two-dimensional kind of quantum gravity. But the endpoint here is special. So the endpoint of this line is where this value, this m2, also becomes equal to zero at the same time as m1 is equal to zero, and m3 is still less than zero. So this reminds you, in terms of ordinary statistical mechanics, we have a phase transition line here, and it stops here. And at the endpoint, you can have a different critical behavior. And indeed, we have a different critical behavior there. Because when we now look at the potential here, we see that it has this form here. So for m1, different from zero, we have just this analytic behavior. When this is close to the boundary, this was branch polymers. When m1 was equal to zero and this was different from zero, we had 3/2. This was two-dimensional gravity. Now, if both of these are equal to zero, the leading behavior is 5/2. So what is it? And, well, I will not prove that for you, but I'll just tell you in words what it is. It turns out that it becomes two-dimensional quantum gravity coupled to a conformal field theory with central charge C equal to minus 22. It's a minimal conformal field theory. In fact, the simplest one which exists, I would say. It's a so-called, in PQ terms, conformal field theory. It's a 2.5 conformal field theory. And in statistical modeling, it's what's called the Li-Yang edge singularity. So why is it equal to that? Well, I will not prove it to you. I will just tell why is it equal to that. So it's equal to that because of the following. You have these squares. So this is a beautiful argument first given by Matthias Staudacker. You see, everybody got this model wrong in the old days. And Matthias Staudacker, he was a graduate student there, and he worked out this wonderfully, I would say. This is very nice. So because people just used some formal arguments and they thought it was a unitary theory and so on, but they were wrong. So here's the dictionary to convert it into the correct conformal field theory. You have these squares with kind of negative weight. Now draw a diagonal here and represent it by the ordinary triangulations which had triangles which has positive square, but put a diagonal here which you call a dimer, a little rod you put in here. So it becomes an ordinary triangulation but with rods in there. Now the G4, now you have two triangles, so you get D3 squared, and there are two of them, so you get two here. But now this is negative, so you put in order that this should be equal to G4, you put in here a kind of fugacity for these dimers. So the chemical potential for putting in dimers, but you have to take it negative. Now, it turns out that this model has been studied in statistical mechanics, such as dimer models. So people like Baxter, they like to study dimer models, lattices where you put dimers on. And this model, this such a dimer model has been studied, and you can show that it corresponds exactly to such a conformal field theory. So it's a non-unitary conformal field theory with C equal to minus 25. So it's not gravity. It is unfortunately gravity coupled to non-unitary matter. And the problem with this is the following. Well, it is there. So there are theories where you can sum over all genus. It's done here. I mean, the problem in terms of interpretation of this is that these conformal field theories, they have operators of negative scaling dimension. So usually the infrared of these theories, we like the infrared to be dominated by the cosmological constant, like in our real world, and also like in 2D gravity. So we like the cosmological constant to be the one having the highest mass dimension in the coupling constant having the highest mass dimension. But in the case of these conformal non-unitary conform field theory, is not the case. There are other excitations which will dominate in the infrared. So what we see at large distances is totally dominated by these non-unitary theories. So to what extent you want to call it quantum gravity is debatable. But nevertheless, it is a kind of model. And it can be generalized very easily. If you take the next order potential, then you have a higher polynomial here. And now you can fine-tune even further, such that the first three coefficients will be different from zero, and only the last coefficient will be there, and you get a new critical behavior. And this turns out to be a 2-7 conformal field theory coupled to gravity. And in this way, for arbitrary matrix models, you can get a whole an infinite sequence of conformal field theories coupled to 2D gravity, namely the PQ equal to 2m minus 1, where m is equal to 2, 3, et cetera, coupled to this. And for each of these, you can explicitly find the Hartle-Hawke wave function. I've written it down here for genus 0 as a polynomial here times this magic factor. So I want to, I'm running a little bit late, but if you give me 1 minute more, I just want to show that in this framework, it links very nicely to the Wilsonian picture. So I've drawn here the coupling constant space. So this is an infinite dimensional space of coupling constants. I included the boundary cosmological constant in the coupling constant space. Now, the critical surface of this is a surface in this infinite dimensional space of co-dimension 1. And you might remember from your lectures in field theory that it's very important, if you think about renormalizable field theory and so on, that the non-renormalizable actions, they live on an infinite dimensional space where the correlation length is infinite, and the relevant operators are only of finite co-dimension in this infinite dimensional coupling constant space. And we have the same situation here. The critical surface is of co-dimension 1. And kind of generically, the critical behavior comes when, for a given choice of these coupling constants, we fine-tune this to the where the boundary explodes. But these number of these polygons will stay fixed. So generically, we will see branch polymers. So branch polymers is the generic situation in this. However, if we fine-tune the coupling constants, then we get a surface of co-dimension 2, which is 2D quantum gravity. If we fine-tune further, then we get 2,5. And if we fine-tune even further, we get all the other ones. So all this is a kind of beautiful, explicit realization of the Wilsonian picture of critical surfaces and critical points. But now the $1,000 question is here. As you know, with all conformal field theories and all critical phenomena, the driving thing of this is the correlation links. There's always, at the critical point, a divergent correlation link. So two questions here. So where is the correlation links in these things? But even worse, how do we define a correlation links at all in a diffeomorphism invariant theory? And I will turn to that tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Sure.